Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a Master of Arts in Communications to advance careers in media, PR, and journalism. Fuller part-time options, 518-454-5143. From Northeast Public Radio, this is the Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
Well, in honor of the big media stories of the last few days, we're going to introduce ourselves in that context. And so here is George Albert Louis Fussfeld and George Albert Louis Chartok, and I'm George Albert Louis Smith, and we are the Media Project this week.
Well, at the risk of correcting you, I don't go by that name. I go by the name of Carlos Danger Fussfeld.
The big stories of the week. It's the Media Project. Ira Fussfeld, longtime publisher of the Daily Freeman in Kingston. Alan Chartok, CEO of Northeast Public Radio. And I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union. And yes, actually, the royal birth. My goodness, what a big deal is that. What do you think?
I was so pleased with the newspaper profession in my part of the world, up to and including Albany, the day after the birth of the royal baby, to see that the print press had it right. They didn't splash it. They put it inside. They gave it some perspective, unlike the broadcast programs, particularly the morning shows, and certainly cable, which had wall-to-wall coverage of this thing. And as I think it was David Letterman who said, didn't we fight a revolution to get out from under the monarchy? Why is this such a big story? And finally, I saw a report in the Los Angeles Times that said the ratings stunk and that people did not watch the programming in anywhere near the proportion of the coverage on broadcast.
Well, I don't understand it, to be honest with both of you guys. Rex forgot to wish me a happy birthday.
I didn't think you'd want to remember your age.
So I thought I'd do it myself.
There you go, of course.
Okay, but here's the deal. You know, I called it and nobody else did, and I want to say that.
You said it would be a boy or a girl?
I called it. When they brought the prince out and they said, we're not naming him yet, I went on this station. Now, Rex is always critical of my commentaries and the rest of it. He thinks,
always.
He's a little jealous. And I came on the radio 7:34 in the morning, and I said, don't give me that. It's going to be George. And David Cassini said, why George? I said, well, because George is a very prominent name. There was Mad George III. You remember him?
And well, then, I don't think they would name him after that man.
No,
that
but there's a whole
George
series. I think Queen Elizabeth, is it possible it Queen was, Elizabeth's
yes,
father was George?
Queen Elizabeth's father, who's George VI.
George VI.
That's right. There you
so
go.
So I knew it was going to be George. It was quite clear it was going to be George. Where was everybody else? Nowhere. Now, I happen to be somebody who is very admiring of the royal family, and I'm going to stay with that position no matter how much you guys poo-poo it, and I think a lot of Americans are.
Can we admire them without acknowledging that they're not worth nearly the coverage that was given to them in many parts of the media world?
We absolutely cannot.
Oh.
I mean,
Dr. Chartok stands up for fluff on cable. Let's hear it.
We're not talking about fluff.
Oh, no. This is important news.
We are talking about the history of English civilization, of which we are a part here in this country. And the fact of the matter is that they made a few mistakes, like during the Revolutionary War, the War of 1812, and some of these other small small mistakes that they've made, and maybe the colonization of the world that may have been, that may have been wrong also. But they have provided us with language and with dignity, and I'm for them.
Yes, well, I would say to you that I'm much more concerned with Burger King than I am with the future King of England.
Well, Ira, looking at you, I would have
yes,
no doubt
well,
about
I'm
that.
Well, I'm consistent. Let's let the record show I am consistent in my points of view.
It's a wonderful thing. So anyway, folks, if you wish to join this commentary, remember,
why would you?
media@wamc.org is how you offer your analysis of Dr. Shartok's analysis and so much more. All right, so well, so now that we've dealt with that, now to the really big story of the week, which is
my birthday,
Anthony Weiner himself. Anthony Weiner, he who has been running for mayor of New York and whose sexting scandal, this is a word that we've just learned in the last few years, of course.
Yeah, sexting, you take pictures of yourself and you send it on the internet.
Or words or something like yeah. that, text via phone. It has been shown that this has continued until just, in fact, through last summer, long after he left Congress and long after he said that he had been telling interviewers for magazines that he had changed. And now it turns out that he hadn't changed so quickly. And interestingly is... the media handling of it has been almost, if I can characterize the New York City press, it's been almost head-hanging, as though they're somewhat ashamed that this man who suddenly skyrocketed to the top or near the top of the polls for in the candidacy for mayor in this difficult primary is, in fact, who he is.
Rexy, I'm going to take another view of this. I think there's always a hidden power structure in every city, and I think that newspapers are a big part of that, and certainly in our city, yours is the Albany Times Union. And I think that they like to call the shots, and they're used to calling the shots. Now, Freud, you guys may not know about Freud because you haven't studied him the way that I have. But Freud
spent a lot of time with Freud in your political science pursuit.
And
you?
In other places. Freud said very specifically that character was set at 4 and it never changes. So Rex, little Rexy and big Rexy are basically the same character. You were probably beating up on your friends like you beat up on me back then. But okay, so the newspapers are out of it, and now they're angry. I mean, really angry. So they editorialize daily on get out of the race. Why are you in this race? I am less sympathetic to that. I would not vote for this guy. I never liked him, I'll be honest with you. But I think people have a right to make the choice. And I don't think that the press should be making the choice or the editorial boards should be making the choice. They can editorialize, but the rabidness, the fervor with which they are doing this, I think is not good for them or for a democratic society.
So do you think they shouldn't have editorial pages?
No. Rex, you are known to put words in other people's mouths. Anybody who listened to what I just said knows that I have no problem at all with their saying it. It's the fervor with which they're saying it.
Oh, the fervor. So they should write boring editorials then.
Which, believe me, they do all the time.
So you're saying that because the newspapers are accustomed to running things, which would be, I think, shocking news to the journalists who are... Anyway,
you're so condescending.
Because Anthony Weiner is somebody who is not in their claws, unlike all the other candidates.
I don't mean claws. I mean they don't like him. They don't like him. They think that his actions have been disgraceful.
So you're offering that commentary, but you think they shouldn't. You're thinking, well, the newspaper has an editorial. You have the microphones.
Rexy, you're
of
not
going to
get away
station.
With this.
You're playing one role and saying that the newspaper shouldn't play the other.
You're trying this, but it's not successful. And the people who are listening know that the snurdiness with which you approach this subject is not appropriate. You are trying to say, I don't believe in the newspapers doing editorials. I do. I just think that newspapers have the idea that they are important, that they're running things, and they cannot believe that when they say, get out, the guy doesn't get out. That's what I said. I didn't say they don't have a right to editorialize, and you know it.
You said they shouldn't have done editorial.
I don't see any evidence of that.
No, I didn't say that.
I don't see any evidence of that at all.
Yeah,
no, I think you're just making that up.
No, I mean, first of all, since we've gotten past to you acknowledging that the newspapers do have the opportunity and the obligation to do an editorial, again, New York City, we need to parse a bit. You have the New York Times and you have two tabloids. The tabloids are going at this differently and more aggressively.
I don't think that's true.
You don't think that's
no,
true?
I think the New York Times, in its own way, with its own, and I read the Times all day long and all night long most of the time. I got to tell you,
he gets his commentary. All his ideas come from these people who he denounces subsequently.
I'm not denouncing them. I'm just simply saying to you, it happens that the New York Times, by the way, the choice of articles. You guys always say, well, there's an editorial page and then there's the front page. Well, if you read the New York Times as we speak today, they're doing stories about what do women really think of what's going on with this particular case.
Is it not a valid story?
Yes, it is.
Well, so then, what's your point?
Well, let me say, if I talk to 100 people, I can decide who goes in the front part of the article, who goes in the second part of the article, who I listen to,
I
quote, and who I don't. That's right. But journalism has within it an inherent opinion, because the guy who's writing the story or the woman who is writing the story can pick up a little piece of flotsam and jetsam here and put it there and make a huge difference. And you know it.
Well, I'm not in agreement with that, surprise, surprise. But beyond that, it just seems to me that the newspapers covering a community, whether it's a big one like New York City or a small one like the one that I cover, we have an obligation. It's part of our role, we believe, to opine. And in the case of Wiener, you're right. If the voters should have an opportunity to decide, but the newspaper has the obligation to offer an opinion that this guy is not qualified to be the mayor of the greatest city in the world. Can you imagine, we joked about it before, can we imagine Anthony Weiner, a.k.a. Carlos Danger, being the mayor of New York City? Is that the city that the people of New York want to have? And it seems to me it's the newspaper's role and obligation to take a higher ground and to try to reveal and discuss this in case people are getting carried away saying, oh, he's just being vilified. It's just about sex. It's more than just about sex. It's about character. It's about psychosis. And it's about the reputation.
Psychosis, that's a libel. Oh, how do we know it's psychosis?
Well, it's not a libel, I don't believe.
Okay, but let me ask you a question. You know, the newspaper says, they don't say that the people should decide not to have him. They say, get out.
Yeah.
They say, get out.
Right.
Now, why is it that the people who have him up in the polls right now, as we read the polls this morning, he's leading in the polls? So what if the people want a mayor who offers them a little page six-ish, who is out front on this, who's interesting to them, who happens to be a progressive, a liberal? I'm not for him, but if that's what they decide, why should the newspapers not allow that?
Well, the newspapers allow that, Alan. You're just saying that they should be restrained for some reason to not say that he shouldn't be running.
By the way, you keep putting words in my mouth, but the truth of the matter is I think they have every right to write editorials.
They just shouldn't write editorials that say forcefully what
they
believe.
No, I'm talking about the sociology. Come on, Rexy, let's get it from the basement up a couple of floors. I'm saying that the sociology of how we rule ourselves, including the role of newspapers and radio stations, public radios, everything else, should be analyzed in terms of how we make our decisions. And I am simply saying that I have the sense that the newspapers are outraged that they are not being listened to.
What would happen? Let's presume for the sake of the discussion that Anthony Weiner continues in the race, wins the Democratic primary, gets into the general, is running against a Republican. I think Leota is his name.
Ketsamini.
Yeah. So they're the candidates, and the New York Times and any other newspaper editorializes in its endorsement not to vote for Anthony Weiner, a.k.a. Carlos Danger, et cetera, et cetera. And that is the advice that it is giving the public. Now, that doesn't mean the public has to listen, and it certainly doesn't mean the public isn't going to vote, but the newspaper has a role to offer this opinion. And as is the case right now, they're trying to urge this guy, Anthony Weiner, get the heck out of the race. You're sullying the race. You're taking the focus away from the issues of New York City, of which there are numerous.
And yet, Ira, the people are for him.
Then
now,
that's
what's
fine,
that
but
about?
The newspaper, well, if you're telling me the newspapers don't have as much influence as they used to, well, that's not a scoop. But so what?
Have they brought that on themselves?
I don't know. You want us to write an editorial that people agree with so we'll be popular?
Not at all. You guys keep...
it's the logical extension of what you're saying.
No,
you just don't have
any
logic behind your point.
No, I have tremendous logic, and I'll bet the people who are listening to this station know what I mean.
You know, Rex, when we...
And know your futile efforts to put words in my mouth are not going to be successful.
2 weeks ago, when you weren't here and I was sitting in your chair, we had this discussion about Weiner and Spitzer, and I was kicking myself as I was driving back to Kingston because I didn't use that argument that he just used in reverse, saying the people who are listening to this program know that we're right and Alan is wrong. So.
Well, I want everybody to understand what's going on in this room, because it's not television, it's radio. We got these two guys with graying hair patting each other on the back and saying, aren't we terrific? And who are you, you interloper? That's what you're saying.
Yeah, well, I want to know, as you always say, the people who are driving home on the Taconic after their weekend in the Berkshires, many of whom live on the Upper West Side, are listening to this.
What's wrong with that?
Nothing is wrong with that. They're listening.
Why are you implying that people who live on the Upper West Side are no good?
No, I'm implying that's who listens to the station.
Now I've done to you what you've been trying to do.
You see, you folks from the Upper West Side who weekend in the Berkshires, how he's diminishing your listenership. I'm acknowledging your listenership and pointing out that you are no doubt saying, as you're driving home, thinking about whether, as I would, whether how many bagels to buy in Zabar's tomorrow, that this is not the guy we want representing us in the city
Ira
of New York.
Ira Fussfeld. Yes. Ira Fussfeld. F-U-S-F-E-L-D.
Yes.
You are really coming down on my people. And not only that, you forgot about the people in Park Slope. They don't have a Zabar's.
They have a Fairway Market.
Do they have WAMC?
On the Taconic right now, they do.
I'm being envious of those folks who can just walk out of their apartments and get those bagels.
I'm envious of those who can walk out of the WAMC listening area. Anyway, this is a...
Now it all comes out.
Oh, I'm very pleased about that. Anyway, we're here. Speaking of problems in the media, there is an issue that has been raised by the CEO of the company that Ira works for. His name is John Payton. He started out on the editorial side of things, and he's
what
now.
What place
become...
does he live in?
He lives in Manhattan.
He's
probably, if he was up here, he'd be a listener.
You guys didn't get it, did you? Payton Place.
P-A-T-O-N.
Okay.
Anyway, he's now the head of this big thing called Digital First Media, which runs about $1.3 billion a year in revenue.
Yeah, second largest newspaper company now in the country.
In terms of number of papers, quite remarkable, including Ira's paper in Kingston, which has a new redesign, which I'm looking at as I hear as we speak.
We'll hold it up to the microphone so that everybody else can see it, Rex.
It's a lovely
thing. Ridiculous.
Anyway, one of the things that he has raised concerns about is this something called native advertising, which is the hottest thing going these days. And native advertising is, as he says, it's advertorial, but any other name isn't it? And I appreciate the fact that he's offering some concerns about this. This is, oftentimes, people can't tell the difference between what is advertising and what is editorial. And it's a very dangerous slope. This is happening a lot in magazines. It's increasingly happening in newspapers. Of course, on television, it's been going on for years
I'm describing it.
In television, you have these programs that are paid programs.
Like talk shows.
Right. And in fact, it's advertising. And now they're beginning to do that. You have articles and papers that we try to make sure that everything is labeled advertising if it mimics it. And we have certain fonts, for example, we only use in the newspaper in the editorial stuff.
Right. But you do it.
Yes. Not brand new.
No, that's right. And very respectable part of journalism, to be honest with you. People come and they say, oh, we'll give you a certain amount of money. And you say how much. And they tell you or you tell them and they say yes. And then you put it in. And sometimes you put a little tiny thing at the top saying, you know, this is an advertisement.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Usually we make it so that people can tell, but there is this trend, and it troubles me, and it's of concern, I think, that it's being pushed by advertising managers and executives in a lot of industries, and that is to try to conceal it. And advertisers love this, of course, because it puts this content into people's hands. But the point that... that Payton says is a big part of the value proposition to advertisers and readers is that it's trusted. What happens when we abrogate that trust is a question I haven't been able to resolve. I think native advertising is asking me to take sandpaper to that relationship and buff it down just a little bit to let native advertising slide through. It's a heated debate inside this place.
Okay, so now you have this humongous company, and I have nothing but respect for Mr. Payton, and he comes out and he says, okay, we have to look at this thing because we're worried about what it... But his newspapers are in bankruptcy.
Well, we're out of bankruptcy.
Let me change that. Have been in and out of bankruptcy.
Yes. And only the former Journal Register company, Digital First Media, also manages another company that was not in bankruptcy.
Okay, but he has to bring home the bacon, otherwise he's toast, right?
Yeah.
Well, that is the debate, and it's not just a debate among companies that have been in bankruptcy. And by the way, this advertorials or native advertising, again, we'll talk about the New York Times. As far back as I can remember, and in particular when Albert Shanker led the teachers' union, he had an advertorial on the op-ed page, I believe, on Sundays.
Which I always thought should have been a regular paid piece.
Well, it was.
It is paid.
Yeah, it was.
No,
paid.
I mean the Times should have paid him to do it because it was very interesting
stuff.
There's
a lot of readers among the New York City teaching community.
Well, and everybody else was. There's a huge educational debate going on. I always thought it added a great deal. My mother thought that Albert Shanker was, you know, very important, almost a religious figure. She was a teacher, and I think that that's right. But here's Peyton, and I'm interested in this guy because I have tremendous respect for him, and he's talking out loud, and that's the one thing he does very well.
Yes, he's very good at this.
He likes to parse issues as the same way we do here on the Media Project, no matter how much abuse I take.
Well, I think Peyton, I have more confidence in Peyton doing the right thing, and that is maintaining that line between advertising and news content than I might some other CEOs. And the reason is he came up on the news side. And although he is in charge now of such a large company that needs to generate the revenue, I've already seen examples of him pulling back on areas that perhaps cross the line in specifically. And I don't know that Rex's or Alan, you've seen this, but there are some sites, newspaper websites, where keywords are underlined, and you click through those keywords to get an ad. Or no, I'm sorry.
Or they're in blue.
Right, they're in blue, and if you put your cursor over the word, an advertisement will
pop.
Oh,
is that right?
And that sprung up, no pun intended, very early on.
Why, are we talking about Wiener again? No,
and it was brought to his attention, and he took those down. He was not aware of those going in, and he took them down. So he has that track record. But that said, I think all of us are concerned about it. We've got to generate advertising, and a lot of advertisers have more sway than perhaps they used to when we could just say, the hell with you, that's not the way we're going to run things. Now we have to listen a little bit more closely.
He had two other bits of prognostication that were interesting in this interview that I recently saw. One is
how recently?
the printing schedules. He noted that he scaled back the print schedule in Oneida, New York, earlier this year, and this prognosticates a print reduction elsewhere. He said, "I think so." And he
went a little fast there. I wasn't quite sure what you were saying.
Fewer days of the week.
Yeah, Oneida went from a 6-day paper to a 3-day paper. Right. They added a Sunday paper, which they didn't have. So I think they print Thursday, Sunday, and I'm not sure what the other day is, Tuesday perhaps.
And, you know, this is happening in a number of markets where either a very, very scaled back daily paper, like in Syracuse, for example, a little tiny paper on 4 days a week and a full paper on three.
Now, my newspaper, the Legislative Gazette, which I am the publisher of, the executive publisher of, and brings young people to Albany to write about the legislature, we saved a tremendous amount of money by going digital for the whole summer.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, we were doing 52 weeks a year, and now we do everything during the academic semesters. But the third, we're still on doing it, but we're online.
So you save money. And think about this, though. The difficulty is if you're the only newspaper in a community and if you go digital, what you're saying is that is the only way that news is going to get out to people. In the Legislative Gazette, with all due respect, that reporting is replicated elsewhere. It's not as though people rely upon that as their only source of information for certain kinds of news. So this is an important element for community newspapers to say that. And the second thing he points out is that over the next decade, he thinks that there's going to be a double-digit percentage reduction in the amount of daily newspapers in the United States. Lots and lots of newspapers going out of business. So, you know, it's just interesting to see that all coming forward, coming from the CEO of a company that, as you say, it owns more newspapers than almost anybody.
The Denver Post is one of the top five papers, not only in size, but in quality in this country. And, you know, that's the group that we're talking about.
Yes, but I'm also looking at those who are opportunistic now, because we do know that localities, small local papers, are doing somewhat better than are the other guys. So I see evidence that there are people who are trying to open smaller papers, maybe once a week or twice a week, who are going to try to eat the lunch of the big guys.
You know, and there's a good possibility of that happening. The only thing is that there is an organization already in place for the existing organizations. That is, if you look even at a newspaper that is not doing well, they have an infrastructure. They have a small newsroom.
They got a printing press,
or else a digital presence already. And so that embedded asset is something that
huge.
A startup is going to have trouble competing with on a local level.
Yep.
So there's some resilience.
And
there.
Journalism, as we've said here, is expensive. You're going to find good journalists to work 2 days a week. You still have to pay pay them.
So really, on that point, we're out of time already.
Man. Look, if I've said anything that offends either of you, I want to apologize. I want to apologize.
Happy birthday. We're very happy it's your birthday.
I had a birthday this year also.
Many happy returns. I don't think we celebrated yours, did we?
No, just the other day.
All right.
They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ding-a-ling-ling, city desk. Pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press. Now, you remember Mrs. Sadie Smuggery. She wanted money to buy a new fur coat. To get insurance, she employed skullduggery. She up and cut her husband's only throat. She chopped him into fragments. She stuffed him in a trunk. She shipped it all back yonder to her uncle in Podunk.